The question today, to rent or to buy?
So if you live in a city that has rising rents, for example, those rents are going to continue to go up while your housing cost in a home you purchase is going to stay flat.
We'll get advice from realtors for those of you who might be on the fence between renting and buying in Illinois. If you've got a question for our experts, give us a call, 1-800-222-9455, or tweet to 21st Show. Plus, we'll speak with the authors of a new book out next month about the Enneagram, an ancient personality typing system. Why does it matter?
I feel like self-awareness is an obligation I have to truly love other people, because as long as I'm not self-aware, I'm banging guardrail to guardrail, no doubt hurting others or limiting their potential, for sure limiting mine.
The authors will also address the question, what does all of this have to do with spirituality? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to finding a place to live in Illinois, everyone's faced with the same question, is it smarter to rent or buy? This can be one of the biggest decisions people make in their life, and it's a difficult one, especially depending on your work, your financial situation, or what part of the state you're in. If you have questions or tips on deciding between renting or buying, you can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. We've got some realtors here to answer your questions. Again, the number, 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. In a minute, we're going to be joined by Jonathan Todd. He's a data analyst for NerdWallet. But first, I want to bring in Jared Enright, a Chicago real estate agent with Crane Real Estate, and Merrill Otwin, a realtor with Home Buyers Advantage in Edwardsville, Illinois, just outside St. Louis. Merrill, Jared, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
Nice to be here.
Jared, what are you telling people right now who are deciding between renting and buying?
I tell my clients that the most important thing to do when deciding whether to rent or to buy is to sort of look at your situation. If you plan to stay where you're going to be for at least 3 to 5 years, I recommend buying. It's usually cheaper than renting. You have a lot more control, tax deductions. There's a lot of advantages there. Being in Chicago and having such a transitional market, I find that sometimes, you know, if you're only going to be here for a year, you just started a job, it might not be the best thing for you to buy. Maybe you want to, you know, dip your toe in the water and see if Chicago's for you. Best way to do that is kind of test it out via rentals, I find. So that's sort of how what I recommend to my clients.
Right. And so think about us. We're talking about this around the state. We've got lots of different people around the state tuning in. I know if you think about the Champaign-Urbana area, because of the University of Illinois, another place where people think of it as kind of a transitional market. Merrill, how about you? You've been in real estate for more than 3 decades in Edwardsville, Illinois. What are you seeing? What's changed in the past few years? Are you seeing more people buying or renting homes right now?
We're seeing, in response to higher and higher home prices, we're seeing higher pressures on rental units. The universal wisdom that came out of the Chicago area still prevails down here, and we see more pressure on rental units. And if people can afford it, we make the same recommendation. You know, it's always advantageous to buy if you know that you're going to be stable in that community for a bit. We live in a university town. And so we have a lot of recent graduates that enter the professional world, and they want to stay light on their feet. And they're obviously renters for a period of time. But we're seeing that as a phenomenon that influences life here. And we work in O'Fallon, Illinois, which has a Scott Air Force Base nearby. So there are a lot of rentals there that are based on the same thing. If you're going to be temporary, or if there's a possibility if you're going to be moving or whatever the circumstance, even upgrading the circumstances, why it's always hugely advantageous to buy. Our culture is based on that, and that's a truth that prevails.
Yeah, when we think about that, I want to get back to the culture in a minute and see how much that's changed with the recession and the housing market crash that happened there. But I did want to ask you, Merrill, about, you said upward pressure on rental prices. So you're saying right now that the market you're seeing for home buying is also putting pressure on rent prices and increasing those. Is that correct?
It is indeed. Yes.
Okay. I wanted to bring someone else into that, into this conversation. It's Jonathan Todd. He's a financial writer for NerdWallet. He did a study on Illinois' buying versus trends, renting trends last year. He looked at 327 Illinois cities and how feasible it is to rent or buy a home there. We're going to tweet out that link. If you follow 21st Show, 21ST Show, you can see that. Hey, Jonathan, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, Nella. How are you?
Good. What did you find about the main findings versus renting and buying in Illinois? I imagine it's very place-specific?
Yeah, it's definitely place-specific. Illinois, you know, of course, a big state. It's sort of anchored up north by Chicago, the Chicago suburb. But, you know, that doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of good choices for people, no matter what age you are. So, for example, like we said before, how there's a lot of college students downstate. There might be a lot of good opportunities to rent for a bit for people starting out their careers. You know, and then they sort of move their way up the ladder to buy a home. And so Illinois is a great state, has a lot of great communities, and has a lot of options for somebody who's looking to rent or buy.
Right. Based on your research, where are you seeing? Are you seeing people rent or buying more in particular parts of the state? Are you seeing more rentals in Chicago versus maybe home buys in other parts of the state? What did your research show?
Exactly. Chicago, for example, is quite expensive to buy a home relative to a lot of other communities in the state. And so you do see a lot of people renting there because it does make sense to them. The cost to rent versus the cost to buy skews a bit towards renting. So it does make sense in a place like Chicago to rent for a lot of people.
And I imagine as you're talking about the cost of rental, how much it costs to save up for a down payment in Chicago, places like Danville, Springfield, Decatur. How much time does it take to save up for a down payment for a home if you're looking at a Danville, a Springfield, or Decatur versus, say, a Chicago?
Sure. Well, in Chicago, it's about 1 year of median income. That's equivalent to 20% of a median home in Chicago. So it takes about 1 year if you were to allocate all of your income to save up for a down payment. And somewhere like let's say Springfield, it's less than half a year, so it's much more affordable. It's much easier for somebody to save up for a down payment for a home in some other communities downstate, for example, like Springfield.
And I want to get back to that cultural question. And Jared, I wanted to ask you this in terms of what Merrill was saying about the culture of, we've always had a culture of home buying. You know, it's always been, this is the American dream. You should aspire to buy a house. Jared, have you seen that change since the recession and the crash?
A bit, especially with sort of the younger buyers, millennials, recent college graduates. Given the debt-to-income ratio when you get out of college versus, you know, say 10 years ago, it's a lot harder to come up with that down payment. Also, you know, loans have really tightened up their criteria. You know, so if you're going to apply for a loan today versus, say, you know, 10 years ago, you've got a lot more hoops to jump through as a young person. So when, with respect to that culture change, I think it's pretty evident in general. Generational aspects. You know, it just seems like it's a lot harder for somebody younger to get that loan than it would have been, you know, 10, 15 years ago, both with the debt that they've incurred typically and, you know, the tightening loan restrictions.
Jonathan, I know there was actually a recent study that NerdWallet did about millennials and whether or not millennials are more inclined to rent and buy. What are you seeing with that? Does that kind of square with what Jonathan's saying? I'm sorry, with what Jared's saying?
Sure. I think it sounds that a lot of millennials would actually like to buy homes, but for a variety of reasons, they're sort of skittish on the idea. One of them sort of has to do with the bank financing. A lot of millennials don't necessarily have the credit to get a good loan at this point in time. So, for example, a third of millennials don't meet the industry standard minimum credit requirement of 620. So that could be a bit of a detriment. But that's not to say that there aren't other ways to get a mortgage, especially if somebody has a bit higher of a credit rating. It's just that, again, millennials don't think that they have the credit score, or they don't think they can afford the down payment, or they don't think they can afford the monthly payment for a home. But that's not necessarily the case. I think if a lot of people sort of sat down and ran the numbers, they would find that there are more opportunities out there than they expect.
Merrill, what do you say? Merrill, what do you say to younger people who come to you and are thinking about the financing? What are you seeing with bank financing right now, first of all?
Well, I think it's tougher than it was, and maybe deliberately so. because of the fact that these are the folks that got into trouble during the recession. Whatever the cause, they took some of the heat for it because they were accused of buying homes when they shouldn't buy a home, with low and encouraged with low down payments and all kinds of other incentives to do that. But and so in reaction to that, all the regulatory agencies have, including those that regulate banks, have really tightened down the restrictions on borrowing. So it's harder to get the money together. You have to prove that you've earned it and can earn it in the future to a higher level than you did before. Credit ratings are higher, are of higher importance than they were before. So, yeah, it's tougher, and made deliberately so during this period. I think that the general wisdom of buying over renting still prevails, and it's a generational thing in that it's passed from that principle is passed from generation to generation. Wise fathers like to instill that wisdom in their kids, and so they look to buy when they can. And there are other obvious benefits of ownership once you're settled and know where you're going to be that push people in that direction. But it's tighter than it was. And yet there are ways, as we've heard just with the people here, there are ways to circumvent that, including loans from relatives and that sort of thing. But it's
are you seeing more of that? Are you seeing more of people doing, families doing loans? I've had friends whose parents have taken out, parents who have had basically their house paid off, take out maybe a line of credit on their house to have a loan for a down payment. Are you seeing more families doing things like that, given the lending environment we've seen in the past couple of years? Meryl, you are seeing that?
Yeah, we see a lot of that. And even actual ownership where they intend to either give or whatever, make it easier for the offspring to buy into that later on. But we're seeing a lot of more parental help. And those rules that I just spoke of are being relaxed little by little. And as I heard here moments ago, there are ways that you can work that to your advantage. You just have to be careful so that you don't really get yourself into hot water. And we counsel that all the time, too, because there's nothing worse than putting somebody in an untenable, unworkable situation.
So what are the basic, Meryl, what are the basic finances of that to avoid someone being in hot water? What are the basic rules of thumb about how much you should be spending on a house? What are ways that you like to counsel people on that?
Well, we push that decision off to a lender and encourage them to be realistic about it and encourage the borrower to be realistic about it, too, because they're the ones that establish a rule. But there are established principles that you shouldn't spend more than 30% or something on house payments or rent or whatever the situation might be. And you've got some other guidelines that we go by, but we kind of push that off to somebody that we profess, that we claim to be an expert and hope they are. And, of course, those are the ones that have become designated hitters, let's say, in terms of that question.
Mm-hmm. Jared, I wonder what you think about when we think about the Chicago market, how expensive housing prices are. That 30% rule, when you're thinking about prices in Chicago, probably gets violated a lot. That seems like that's a tougher rule to follow. Are there different rules in Chicago, you think?
It definitely is. I think especially when you're in the city itself, you can sort of play with those numbers a little bit. For example, if you're out in the suburbs, you're going to need a car payment, car insurance, all kinds of different things like that. If you're in the city, you can eliminate a lot of those costs, and therefore you can increase the amount of your income that you're willing to spend on housing, given that you don't necessarily have a lot of other costs that you'd have elsewhere. Lawn care, snow removal, small things like that are a lot easier to take care of in the city. So you can definitely play with those numbers, but I agree 100% that putting a buyer or renter with a lender to discuss those options is the best way.
Mm-hmm.
They can sort of, guide them towards making a good decision financially, especially knowing more about their income than we would know.
We're talking about renting, sure. We're talking about renting versus buying in home ownership with a couple of folks, a couple of realtors, as well as a data analyst with NerdWallet who's been looking at the numbers across Illinois. You're welcome to join us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. 5. You can tweet to 21st Show. We've got comments on Reddit and Facebook I wanted to get to as well. And Jared, I wanted to ask you about some advice you might offer. Isaac on Facebook told us he's considering going to the bank for a pre-approved loan to buy a house after having some discussions with friends. And he said he's rented his entire life and never seriously considered becoming a homeowner until now. What kind of advice do you give to someone if they've been renting their whole life about how hard it might be to get a loan now? What are you seeing, Jared?
I think the easiest place to start, obviously, is to talk to either a lender or a bank and see what you qualify for. You may find that, you know, after speaking to a lender, that what you're qualified for might not be something you'd necessarily want to live in or buy, and it might be a smarter idea for you to stay a renter. The easiest way to do that is to sort of begin with your lender and say, hey, look, here's what I'd like, you know, to do. They'll give me a price, and then I'll tell you, you know, how feasible it is to get what you want. So it sounds like he's on the right track to get started. You know, start with the bank, figure out the money. I always tell my clients, don't go to the mall without your purse. You know, if you find something that's a great sale and you're not ready to buy it, you might miss out. So definitely, if you're considering making that transition from renting to buying, figure out your purchase power first, figure out what you want to spend, and then I can help you figure out how to spend it.
And Jared, when you think about the finances, what other advice do you have? Are there sort of maybe one or two tips you have for people in terms of what finances they need to make sure they have in order before they even go to a realtor, before they go to the bank? Where are the best places you find to do research on this, for example, online?
Usually, I like to have everyone sort of come up with a financial plan. The easiest way to do it is go back a year and see what you've spent and how you've spent it. Figure out if you can tighten that up to maybe get a larger down payment. You know, we were talking a little bit earlier. I heard, and I agree, that we've loosened a lot of those lending requirements. They're starting to loosen up little by little from being as tight as they were. The best places to go are to talk to your financial planner, talk to that mortgage broker. The lender at the bank, they'll be able to help you decide, you know, would it be better for you to potentially pay off a car, or would you rather have that cash liquid? Which way is it going to work best for you, in both in terms of monthly payment and for, you know, future investment? Your lender is your friend when it comes to home buying.
Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Jared Enright, Merrill Otway, and Jonathan Todd. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. We're talking about renting versus buying across Illinois. We've been talking about research that was done by NerdWallet. Jonathan Todd is a data analyst with them. He's on the line with us, along with realtor Jared Enright, who's based in Chicago, and Merritt Otwein, who's down in Edwardsville, where he's been in the real estate industry for a couple of decades. And we're talking to you. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st. We've had comments that we wanted to get to as well on Facebook and Reddit. And one comment that we just got on Reddit is, if someone's in a new job or could face a transfer out of state or out of country, renting is the better option. There's lots of factors that tend to get neglected when people look at this argument. One size doesn't fit all. And just to that commenter's point, I was thinking, in the past we used to talk about, Merrill, I wonder if you could start with this. We used to start with thinking, okay, if you're going to be in a place for 5 years, at least it makes sense. Then I've heard 2 years. Do you have a rule of thumb for how you figure out the market and how many years you think you need to be in a place before it makes sense to purchase a home?
I think that rule of thumb would be determined by the strength of the market, in my opinion. The biggest factor then becomes a resale. Are you going to get out of it what you've got, what you put into it, including realty fees probably on both ends and some other costs and that sort of thing? You have to be pretty sure that you're going to get out of it what you put into it when you do resell. So in hot markets, you could go a couple of years and get away with it. We see that in a hot, like a military market, where you've got a lot of activity all the time. On the other hand, if it's even a neighborhood that has slow sales or a city that has slow sales, I don't think you can go that long. I guess I don't feel there's a rule of thumb.
Mm-hmm. And I guess when you think about hot market, how would you, if you're someone who's new to this, how would you figure out whether or not it was a hot market, Merrill?
Well, that's a good question. And I think that's subjective to, like, a realtor's feeling about the future resale of that very home. Is it going to last that long? Is it in a market where there's going to be buying pressure in the future? Is there anything about the neighborhood that's going to distract from future value? Something unknown even that could happen next door that would damage it? Is the general economy stable? All kinds of factors affect resale. We happen to be an exclusive buyer's agency, and we've done that for more than 25 years. We haven't taken a listing except our own property for 25 years. So we look and we add that dimension to every buyer that we take in, and as what's the resale factor? Because I'm convinced, deep in my heart, that the biggest monetary benefit we give our clients is when they resell the home we help them buy.
Mm.
We can't promise we're going to get bargains going in, but we have, as realtors, in the market, immersed in it daily, we should have a better idea what the future is for every neighborhood than anybody else would have, maybe an appraiser. But nevertheless, I think that's situational. No rule of thumb for me, at least. It depends upon the specific instance.
Jonathan, you actually lived in Chicago for 8 years before you moved out east. I wonder what were some of the factors in your decision to rent all the 8 years you lived here rather than buy a house?
So part of it was I was in school, so I was renting. And then, once I was a young professional, in the city in Chicago, I wasn't exactly sure where I was going to end up in the long term. Chicago's a great city. I met my wife there, but again, we moved closer to family. Out east. And so, considering that, having that sort of in our mind, we didn't think it necessarily made sense to buy in Chicago at the time. So just like what we were just talking about, I think renting allows for a degree of flexibility that you don't necessarily get when buying. And so for people who might not be in a place for that long, might not be in a particular city for that long, that's an opportunity to rent, and that might make more sense, regardless of what the rent-to-buy ratio might be.
Mm-hmm. And I mentioned we've been talking to people about this on social media all morning on our Facebook page, on Reddit. One person said on Reddit that what they did was they bought a house and they started renting out rooms, and they had tenants and they're paying rent for each room individually. And eventually this person realized not only were they covering their mortgage, they were making a profit. And Jared, I wonder, are we seeing people get more creative with their living situations in recent years? Are we seeing more people thinking of strategies like this, where I want to make sure that I'm really in a home that not only I can afford, but maybe is helping pay for itself in a way?
Absolutely. One of the biggest things we're starting to see is temporary rentals. We didn't have so much of that. I practiced in St. Petersburg, Florida for a while, which was a very big vacation community. So, daily rentals, weekly rentals were very popular there. Chicago, where I'm from and where I've been for a while now, I didn't see that so much. And now we're starting to see that, Airbnb, the advent of, the Airbnb, where you can get, a downtown trip, for a couple, 3 days at a time. I have a lot of people doing that. We also have a lot of people that do double up on the roommates. I see college students do that fairly often, where, one kid will, sort of buy the house and then have a few roommates to help cover it and maybe even make some money on the side. We are seeing a transition to that, I think, here that we really didn't have, 5-7 years ago.
Well, when I think about that transition, Jonathan, I just want to go back to what the study that NerdWallet did about millennials. It showed that millennials were inclined to rent longer, put off buying longer for generations before then. We've talked about some of the reasons why that is. Obviously, when we think about college debt in the past couple of years, that's been a huge factor in this, as well as other temporal issues about jobs. But I wanted to ask all of you guys what you think the long-term implications of this are. If we're seeing younger generations wait longer to buy, where you think we're going with that? Meryl, what do you think?
Wow. I think that traditional values and systems will prevail and be very inelastic in terms of accommodating to that, particularly when you've got the influence of the times. You've got the influence of a depression on that situation, and I would really like to see NerdWallet's total resume or feeling about it. And we got the ideal guy on this to tell us. But what if there were reservations made on the fact that there was, during this period of time, a major recession that we all accommodated to? So I guess I'm old enough to say I'll stick with older values. They're pretty stable in that regard.
And
older mores.
Well, I appreciate that we have different generations involved with this conversation. Thanks for that, Merrill. I mean, Jonathan, when we think about the research that NerdWallet did on millennials, what are you seeing in terms of, is it a different thing than what Merrill reflects in terms of attitudes about when to be homeowners?
Well, that's interesting. So, again, like I mentioned before, a lot of millennials don't necessarily think they're in a position to be homeowners. But if you actually look at the numbers, the median age for a first-time home buyer was 31 years old in 2015, and that's basically the same as the 30.6 years old in 1970 to 1974. But the interesting part here is that two-thirds of millennials haven't reached that home buying age of 31, and 22% are under 25 years old. So it seems like there's a giant cohort, a giant bulge of millennials that aren't quite to that 31-year-old home buying age yet. And so I think, you know, you look down the line and you can see the opportunity for a huge number of millennials getting in the home ownership market. For example, millennials are expected to form 20 million new households by 2025. So that's definitely something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. And Jared, I'll let you have the last word on this in terms of how you're seeing the millennial impact on the market, particularly in Chicago, and what you think the long-term implications of this are.
Sure. It seems like most of the major sales that we've had lately, especially at the higher prices, have been new construction, which tends to be a generation after the millennials. There's really not a lot out there in their price range right now. So I think that having them join the market at a later time, I think we're going to see a big push here in the next 5 to 7 years where they will start buying more and more. I expect a pretty big increase in that just based on the fact that we're finally confident enough that what you're buying is going to be worth something later. You know, I don't think that a lot of millennials felt that, you know, especially in the last 5 to 7 years. You know, you never knew what you were buying was going to be worth something later. And I think that they need to have that confidence to move forward. And I think that confidence is finally starting to come back.
And Merrill, are you typically selling homes, you think, to older people? What are you seeing with is it more income level as opposed to age?
Well, we're seeing the later development of households, and I think it's, you know, consistent with what I'm hearing here is that the fact that people are getting married later, all kinds of things have delayed that. But again, I'm going back to the fact that we've been through a major recession, which skewed that whole program, and I think it's going to rebound. Yeah, I think there's some pent-up demand that's going to be exhibited in the market sooner than later in that regard from a millennial point of view. I think the old values still prevail. You're talking to an old-timer here, and so it's a matter of I've seen it come and seen it go, and it's inelastic. It's reluctant to go into a different mode permanently.
That's Merrill Otwain with Home Buyers Advantage joining us from Edwardsville. I want to thank Jared Enright with Crane Real Estate in Chicago and Jonathan Todd, a data analyst with NerdWallet, as well as all the people who contributed to our conversations on Facebook and Reddit. Thanks so much. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Niall.
Thank you. You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to The 21st and Myla Boodoo. Who hasn't fallen prey to a Facebook quiz that helps you figure out your personality, or the most recent craze, the Harry Potter figure out your Patronus quiz that was all the rage last week if you saw it? Personality quizzes are always fun, but there's an ancient personality typing system called the Enneagram that has seen renewed interest, and it's coming from Christian circles. Some might be surprised at this intersection of faith, spirituality, and psychology, but Episcopal priest Ian Morgan Cron and Enneagram master Suzanne Stabile both came into this in their own way. Their new book is called The Road Back to You, an Enneagram Journey to Self-Discovery. In it, they make the point that knowing more about ourselves isn't just important for self-discovery and relationship with others, but also our relationship with God. The book is out next month. They're actually launching it tomorrow in Chicago at the Y Christian Conference, and that's where they join us from now. Ian, Suzanne, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Ian, I wanted to start by sharing the story about, and I think this probably maybe displays more about my personality than anything else, but we all took the Patronus, what's your Patronus quiz last week, and we were all taking it in the office, and I didn't like the response I got because I wanted a dolphin, so I took it again until I gamed it, so I got that response. But I think that this is so much in the, it's I don't want to say it's a fad, I just feel like it's so much a part of social media to be doing these sorts of personality quizzes, and I think people maybe are a little skeptical about all of these. You actually, I think maybe Stuart came to this with some skepticism. I wonder if you could share a little bit of how you came into thinking about paying more attention to our personality types.
Sure. Well, what's interesting is, by the way, on those quizzes, those, you know, a lot of them serve as clickbait, right?
Right. So, exactly.
But isn't it interesting that they've chosen personality tests to be what they hope will, marketers hope will lure people into conversation with their product? I mean, there's a genuine hunger for people to develop self-knowledge, so much so that marketers are using it to draw them in. You know, for me, I was drawn to the Enneagram years ago. I was in seminary at the time and in a counseling program. And the moment I read it, I remember thinking to myself, holy smokes, first of all, this is an uncannily accurate depiction of how people in different, you know, categories or types habitually and predictably act, think, feel, react, see the world, process information. So much that I remember when I first read my type, I was just stunned. I mean, I actually felt so exposed that I, you know, kind of wanted to hide under the bed. But I do think there's such a terrible hunger for self-knowledge in the culture, and I think the Enneagram is a wonderful tool to help people to accomplish that.
Suzanne, where does the Enneagram come from? What do we know about it?
We're not actually sure where it comes from. We know that it's centuries old, and we know that in terms of Christian tradition, the Desert Mothers and Fathers made references to the Enneagram. It was an oral tradition, actually, until the mid to late 1970s, there wasn't anything published about the Enneagram, so it's a relatively new opportunity for people to read about the Enneagram. Prior to that, people were taught by spiritual directors or by spiritual masters, and they were only taught their own number, which is helpful in some ways because that's really, you're the only thing you can do anything about. You can't change other people. I have become aware over the years that it has been across all faith beliefs and that it seems to be accessible pretty much for everybody. Father Rohr invited me to teach with him in Europe about 5 years ago in Assisi, and we taught the Enneagram to people from 21 countries who spoke 17 different languages of all ages, and everybody got it. So I think it's old. We're not sure of the origin, and so we're not hanging our hat on any particular story about how we got it.
And so this is a personality type system. You mentioned numbers. Can you explain a little bit about how many different numbers there are, just briefly to us?
Sure. There are 9 numbers. They could be colors or trees or flowers. They happen to be numbers. And so no number is more important than any other. The first one is called the perfectionist, and they're just people. Ones are people who see the world in terms of what could be improved. The twos see the world in terms of who needs help. The threes see the world in terms of how they can get people to follow them to make the world a better place, hopefully. Fours see all the texture that's in the world. Fives like to read about the world and understand how things work. They want to be able to perceive everything. Sixes are usually kind of scanning the horizon for what might go wrong, so they're loyal and they protect the rest of us a lot of the time. Sevens see the world as a smorgasbord. Eights see the world as needing justice and think it's their responsibility to mete out that justice. And nines see two sides to everything that happens in the world.
When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Suzanne and Ian about their book. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll be right back. back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about personality types with Ian Cron and Susan Stabile. They're authors of The Road Back to You and Enneagram 2 Self-Discovery. And we've been talking about this ancient personality typing system and what it all means for people today. And Ian, you know, you make the point in the book that the word personality comes from the Greek persona, which means mask. And I wonder what you think tends to mask our personalities as we go from children to adults?
Sure. You know, as little kids, we instinctually, for purposes of, you know, self-protection, put on a mask to cover over parts of our authentic self and to make our way in the world. You know, it's, personality theory is very complicated. So I think we would say that the personality is made up of innate qualities and coping strategies, defense mechanisms, and that get reflected in the way that we act, think, and feel on a predictable, consistent basis. And I think this mask becomes increasingly layered and complex over time. And when that happens, we lose connection with our true selves, and we start to identify with our personalities. You know, we start to presume that, oh, that's who I am. When in fact, that's not the case. And sadly, when we over-identify with personality, we just lose touch with that person, that beautiful essence of who we are, what Frederick Buechner called the shimmering original self. And one of the gifts of the Enneagram, is, of course, is that it begins to help us recognize and disidentify with those parts of our personality that consistently get us into trouble.
Well, and it's an interesting distinction that you make, Ian. Suzanne, I wonder if you could jump in here. The distinction between personality versus true self. Suzanne, how would you make that distinction? How would we know the difference?
One of the things I say when I'm speaking is that I spend my life teaching people about who they're not. Personality is kind of what we've put on to make our way in the world. And underneath our personality is where we discover and encounter that we are all beloved sons and daughters of a very loving, very benevolent God. And you know those moments you have when you just connect with somebody, like it's an instant connection and you're aware that it was different than normal meetings? I think those moments are without personality. I think there is just a deep place within each of us where the connection isn't of our creation. We can't make it without personality. We need it. It's how we grow up. It's how we go out in the world. But there is a deeper, better, more holistic part of ourselves that it's covering. So people who do Enneagram work in the second half of life have a tendency to work on allowing their personality to fall away a little bit so they can get back to who they were before they did anything wrong and before they did anything right.
Ian, what do you say to people who are kind of resistant to wanting to do this kind of work, who think, why do I even need to figure this stuff out?
Right. Well, to quote another author in terms of ideas, I mean, you know, it's probably a good thing to know about personality since everybody has one. And to understand how to live well in the context of human community, you know. The Enneagram teaches us that we all see the world through different lenses, you know, and that actually comes as a shock to people. You know, we all presume, well, everyone sees the world like I do, but the truth of the matter is that we all see the world in very distinct ways and process information in different ways. And when you learn that, you can begin to move through the world as a more compassionate, thoughtful human being. And so when people resist, I say, well, you know, it's not a good thing, A, to not know yourself, because you're just going to bang guardrail to guardrail through your life, repeating old patterns from scripts from your childhood that just don't work anymore. And you just won't be able to move intelligently and wisely in the context of human community.
Well, and as you think of that, Suzanne outlined for us before the break the 9 different personality types, but I wanted to ask you about the 3 different sort of rubrics that you all group them under. Ian, you kind of group them under the way people maybe respond or how they kind of what motivates them or how they react to things. And those three groups are anger and feelings and fear. Can you talk a bit, Ian, can you explain a little bit about the anger group of people? It's not just anger, right?
Well, yeah, these are called triads, and the anger triad is this grouping of three types, and where the dominant emotion, or I like to think of it as that their interior atmosphere is characterized by anger, but really that anger, and you know this type of person, right, who sort of radiates energy, and the energy feels kind of combative, you know, like ready to go at it with you. And, this anger type is really worshipped, I think, in segments of American culture. And
when we think about politicians or people who,
Well, for sure. But it's really, it's not so much anger as it is it's intensity. It's this passion at the core. It almost feels like they're overcharged. I always like to think of AIDS as, you know, they're on that 240 volt while the rest of us are on 120, and they just radiate intensity, and it does have at times this angry quality to it, and I think all of us have experienced people like that in our lives.
Suzanne, what about the people, the triad of people who are motivated by feelings? How would you describe that?
Those are people who kind of take in information with their feelings instead of with thinking, or instead of with responding with doing. And part of what connects that group to talking about fear and anger is that just under the surface in the feeling group is shame. And that has to do with who they are, not with things they do. They have just a little bit of shame waiting around who they are as people, how they interact with other people. So with being feeling dominant and struggling with some issues about that they're inadequate, that their image isn't quite right, that there's something wrong with them, they're always climbing over that to get into relationships, whether it's at work or in their family or anywhere in the community.
And what about the fear folks? How would you describe that? That's the third triad.
Those are people who look at the world in terms of what could go wrong. And we actually believe that more people in the world fall into that third group, the group that's concerned about fear, than either of the other two. And they are concerned about the common good. They are either afraid of what happens inside of themselves for one number, outside themselves for another number, and both. And so they kind of scan the horizon for danger and look for what they need to prepare for, and then they stay vigilant and prepared.
Ian, I think you all note in the book that a lot of personality types don't tend to talk about the downside to people's personalities. For example, when we think about people who compulsively want to help, we don't maybe talk about how they tend to neglect their own needs. And then we also never talk about how when someone like that is stressed out, how they react. And I wonder, do you think we tend to focus too much when we're thinking about analyzing ourselves? We tend to focus too much on either entirely the positive or the entirely negative aspects of ourselves?
I think that one of the gifts of the Enneagram is that it does both. And I don't know of any other system that does it as well. I think we do a disservice to ourselves when we only look at the positive or the negative. We need to understand that, you know, as human beings, we're a mixed bag, you know. We are filled with our blessings and blights, that which is, you know, best about us and is often what's worst about us, you know. And it's important for us to be informed about both. You're right that the Enneagram reveals how people will react under stress, how the personality adapts under stress, when it's feeling secure, what the personality is like when it's healthy or simply average or unhealthy. And I think that also is a distinctive of the Enneagram, is that it really takes into account and honors the fact that the human personality is both adaptive and fluid, not static. You know, the Enneagram doesn't put you in a box, we like to say. It tells you the box you're in and how to get out of it. And it does so by in part, having us realize that, you know, the self is always selfing, you know, it's always moving in reaction to what is happening in the environment.
Well, and as you say that, Ian, Suzanne, I can't also help but think about another part of this book that I found really interesting, which is that when we set out these personality types and these nine personality types, and we think of, for example, the challenger, the person who is someone who is has a maybe an aggressive personality or someone who's very straightforward, and how different that person is reacted to based on their gender. And I think that's a really, as you all have been doing this work, I wonder, Suzanne, how much of this also is about knowing how people perceive your personality based on your gender?
I don't really think that plays in every number, but it certainly does hit pretty hard with aggressive women or with men who are more tender and more dependent and more conscious of other folks and what they're feeling. And I think gender difference shows itself primarily, actually, in eights for females and in twos and fours for males. And sadly, in 2016, in our culture, it's still true that eight characteristics, the characteristics of the challenger or the boss, are very appreciable in men, and you get a lot of pushback if you're a female eight with the exactly same gifts and characteristics.
Ian, I wonder, you know, we started this conversation with talking about how many personality tests we see on online and in books, and you said you think the reason people take them is because there is a hunger for them to know more about themselves. But I wonder what kind of response you get from people when they hear about this for the first time, especially as you're presenting them in churches and other faith communities. Do you get a lot of skepticism?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we get all kinds of things, you know. But of course there are, you know, there are people who come to conferences or read books, and they actually by virtue of their personality, may be skeptical, you know, if especially if they're in that fear triad. And we do get some skepticism. One thing we often hear is, you know, are you trying to pigeonhole me or put me in a box? And I'll respond the way I just did a few moments ago, telling them that we want to do precisely the opposite. Other times people express skepticism about this idea that there are nine personality types only. They think that's a very reductive idea. And then we explain that the each personality type, if you think of it more like a color, and we know that there's an infinite number of, you know, reds on the color spectrum, let's say. And so, you know, everybody, if you're in that particular number, you are your own shade, the unrepeatable shade of red. So we were able to address some of that resistance, and interestingly, very rarely does anybody leave after about an hour. They're really pretty hooked in and tracking with us. The skepticism eventually evaporates.
And there's no test in your book. You want everyone to read the whole book to figure out their personality type, which the whole staff, when we found that we were doing this, we all did find a test online and we all did it and we talked about it. But how do you feel about the tests that ask us to do these things online?
Well, so for us, we are a little less enthusiastic about tests than some others are. And
okay.
The reason is that tests can really only measure or kind of attempt to determine your personality by virtue of your traits, you know, how you act. But what really determines your personality type is the underlying motivation that drives those actions, thoughts, and feelings. And a test can't get at that. You have to remember, we all have access and actually behave like all those numbers in a given day. But the question that will get you to your number is underlying motivation, and that's something a test can't reveal. So maybe it can get you into the neighborhood of your number, but I don't think gets you to the actual house.
Really quickly, just if you could answer briefly, we have less than a minute left. Ian, what do you want people to get out of this?
Well, one of the things I want them to get out of it, you know, in many ways, the book, if not always, is deeply informed by, you know, really the genius of Suzanne's teaching. And I want them to be familiar with that. I want them to have access, more people to have access to it. I really want people to grow in compassion. I want them to begin to appreciate difference and to really begin to have self-compassion and live in a world that's increasingly hostile with more love and understanding.
That's Ian Cron. I want to thank also Suzanne Stabil. Their book is called The Road Back to You, an Enneagram Journey to Self-Discovery, which you can get next month. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
We're out of time for today. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about a new report finding the U.S. is entering into a teacher shortage crisis. We're going to be talking about how that's being addressed here in Illinois. Thanks for tuning in today. You can always find us at www.21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You've been listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in.